President Trump declared April the 2nd Liberation Day, where he signed an executive order imposing a minimum 10% tariff on all U.S. imports. Higher tariffs were imposed on 57 countries, ranging from 11 to 50%. As a result, the stock market lost $5 trillion, one of the largest drops in U.S. history, and Trump has since declared a 90-day pause on all nations except China. Hi, I'm Richard Nelson, and you are joining The Commonwealth Matters. Now, Trump's tariff policy is facing harsh criticism, with some saying this will lead to inflation and a recession. Others say that this is an important reset to put U.S. manufacturing, agriculture products, and services on a level playing field. Joining us to talk further is Dr. Brian Dmytrovic, an economist, author, and scholar at the Laffer Center in Nashville, Tennessee. Brian, thank you for joining our podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard.
Hey, you're no stranger to the pod. We've had you on before. You've participated in a CPC event last fall, Towards a Better Bluegrass, and talking about economic policy. And I've come to appreciate your thoughtful and historical perspective when it comes to economic policy. And you can speak in a way that the average person understands. So I appreciate you taking time with us. I want to go to a recent column, Brian, that you wrote in Forbes magazine. And you say that the move from the tariff to the income tax, by the way, the tariff was the primary method of the federal government getting income from the beginning of our country up until the Civil War, when it was we had an income tax for a while. You said it was a reconciliation gesture between North and South at the Civil War's 50th anniversary of Gettysburg in 1913. Now, the South resented tariffs. They thought that they were used by the North to crush their economy, which is interesting economic perspective that you bring up. But is this part of our economic history relevant to today's conversation? As we talk about tariffs being the primary mode of the federal government collecting revenue?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, the tariff carried the revenue load of the United States almost fully from 1789, the first tariff, through 1913. I mean, for one period, 1817 to 1861, the tariff was the only federal tax that there was. And by the early 20th century, it was about two-thirds of federal revenue, and the other was excises on tobacco and alcohol and things like that. So there's no question that the tariff was central, but the crucial thing was that the tariff could not collect a lot of revenue on modern standards. The maximum the tariff could collect is maybe 2 or 3% of GDP. And so therefore, if that had to be the only federal tax or the major federal tax, the federal government had to stay small. And this is when the nation experienced its great prospering, when there was a tariff. But I think the mechanism of that prospering under a tariff was the smallness of government. The size of government under the tariff was very small. And I think that's the connection between why the tariff succeeded so well in concert with the great era of American economic growth.
So Brian, of course, our federal government is much bigger than it was in the for most of the 19th century, or really all of the 19th century. And some would argue that we live in a new day and age, and the federal government should be more involved. And I think, for example, we had the Pure Food and Drug Safety Act in early 1900s. Before then, in the 19th century, we didn't have that. So that the idea of the FDA came along, and federal health inspectors came along. And I guess we could have this debate on whether that's an appropriate function of the federal government. But I think in that same vein, there are those who argue things are more complicated, we're scientific, we're more enlightened, and therefore we need a larger federal government. How do you respond to that?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, truly, the average rate of growth in the 19th century was 4% per year. And in the 21st century, we're growing at under 2%. So we sacrifice half of our yearly economic growth every year, and that compounds to a gaping figure over a period of time. We sacrifice that for what? For a federal bureaucracy? That doesn't sound like an attractive trade. even on these little micro examples, the Food and Drug Administration, as soon as it became an issue, the Federal Reserve seized upon it. Give it a little time. I know Vladimir Nabokov used to make fun of Upton Sinclair, who wrote The Jungle. He said, I can't get these American writers straight. Is Upton Sinclair Lewis? I don't know who they are. Just give it time. It's kind of like, I think, at the TVA here in Tennessee and Kentucky. The private enterprise, as Amity Schleso's, was just about to electrify the whole place. And then just before they could get it done, the federal government swooped in to take all the credit. So, a lot of this is just kind of games. I mean, the American economy did beautifully in the late 19th century.
Yeah. You argued that, well, let me go back to this. Let's talk a little bit more about our economic history. And you say in this, I believe it was in a column in Forbes, that the U.S. had the greatest economy in the history of the world in the 19th century at the apex of the Industrial Revolution. And the tariff was the major federal revenue driver. So if this was the case, we existed for, up until 1913, when we had the federal income tax, but tariff was the major income source of the federal government. So if that was the case, why is it wrong to move back to the tariff today? They're conservative free marketeers saying it's going to hurt our economy. So do those who favor a tariff have a point? Could we realistically move back to a place where we get rid of the federal income tax and depend on a tariff to fund our federal government?
Well, I assure you, if we did that, we'd have a simply fantastic economy, because if we get rid of an income tax, I mean, for Pete's sake, the top earners don't have to pay 37%, 40% on their marginal dollar anymore. Can you imagine the wave of investment that would take place in this country? I mean, the rate of return on high income would soar. And so there'd be all sorts of getting of high income, which means starting businesses, expanding businesses, and the effects economically would be absolutely thermodynamic. Moreover, I know world trade's a little bit larger today. It's been growing at a premium to world GDP for the last 50 years. So you could have a low tariff, a low 15% tariff, like Steve Moore and Steve Forbes suggested. And I don't know what the revenue would be, maybe 6% of GDP. Can you keep your government to 6% of GDP? If you can, you're going to have incredible domestic economic growth, because everyone's going to want to get into the economy with only 6% of a federal government. So, yeah, if we went from being a 22% federal government place to a 6% federal government place, we would have an economy for the ages.
Brian, when you say a 22% federal government, you're talking about the federal spending is 22% of the gross domestic product?
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah. Total government spending's, 35, something like that.
So when you talk about that, let's try to flesh this out a bit. You're talking the budget. You're talking the federal employer staff. You're talking about grants. The whole thing. That's a huge part of our economy. And some say, well, if you begin to cut too quickly, there's going to be huge disruption. People are going to lose their jobs. The grants that went to the colleges and universities, those will be cut off, and jobs will be lost there. So you'll have this, at least a short-term ripple effect, which brings panic. And I would argue that that brought panic to the stock market. We had this huge drop immediately after Liberation Day. But what's your response to that? Should it have been, I guess I'll start with this, should it have been slower, rolled out over a period of time instead of a very quick and immediate pronouncement from the president?
Now, I can say that I am, I can speak with a lot of kind of qualifications and competence about the history and to a good degree the economics. When it comes to the negotiating strategy, that's kind of a separate issue. And if it is the case that the strategy that the president has been pursuing is a very good one, or the best one maybe, for a permanently low or no, zero tariff world, well, then when that occurs, I think we should kind of bless it as such. Well, yeah, that was the proper strategy. But I don't know what kind of criterion of judgment I should impose on that question. I think it would be better if we had a low tariff world, or if we had a a world in which the federal government depended on tariff revenue, that we don't have domestic taxation. So how that's all going to shake out in the future, I don't know. And if we get to a very high tax world like we did in the 1930s with high tariffs and high income taxes, well, that's going to be a very bad world. So we're kind of on the edge of that, those potentialities right now. So I don't know. It could be a very good strategy, but that's something I think maybe we might leave to commentators who have a special expertise in that area. But I do say that it would be very good if other countries lowered their tariffs. It'd be great if the United States lowered its tariff. And it would be great if it lowered its domestic taxation as well. And it is possible through tariffs to relieve the domestic economy of taxation. In fact, that was the model for the great American economy prior to 1913. And that's what I think we should find interesting in this context.
Yeah. Brian, others have argued, though, that Trump is the master negotiator and that he is he's leveraging his negotiation skills to force our trading partners to reduce their own protectionist policies, and that this is just I heard it in another podcast that they're likening this to a poker game. Trump holds all the cards. We've got the largest economy. We create the most wealth in the entire world, and we have for quite a long time. But the argument goes that we've been taken advantage of, that other countries have higher tariffs, they have protectionist policies, they put obstacles in the way to make it more difficult for us to sell our goods and services to them. Some countries are engaged in artificially inflating their currency, which puts us at a disadvantage. And Trump is negotiating. He's trying to create a level playing field so that we are treated fairly, so that our manufacturers, our agriculture industries, our services are operating on a level playing field. And to me, that seems like a good thing. We should insist that there's a level playing field. Are you hearing anything else? Am I missing something in that? If I teed that up pretty well as to what's going on and what's led to this tariff?
Yeah, of course. I mean, it is kind of appalling. I mean, the United States is the biggest market in the world, investment and consumer market. And so if other countries are really trying to export into that market because it's the most lucrative one, but then raise up barriers against their own market, of course, that's offensive in a very clear way. It is. And seeking redress of that through perhaps tariff policy is a perfectly plausible thing to do. I mean, it's perfectly understandable. Maybe it's a good thing. It is kind of objectively odd and unattractive that other countries should try to get into the biggest consumer market, the most lucrative market, and then shut out trade from that market. So, yeah, I think that's a proper role for diplomacy and statecraft. And I am a little kind of amazed that Congress has next to no role in this, given that the entire history of the tariff policy was all congressional based. I mean, the very tail end of it was the president. It was all made in Congress with all the lobbyists. So it's funny just to see it all happen at the executive level. And I think that maybe in the future there should be a kind of a more judicious constitutional retrieval of that power by the Congress. I mean, you could simply argue it's unconstitutional for the president to conduct tariff policy because it's an enumerated power of the Congress in the Constitution. So I think that's all upcoming in the future, that litigation, that jurisprudence.
We are going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. Hi, my name is Richard Nelson, founder and executive director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. We're here to shore up the sanctity of human life, religious freedom, natural marriage, and sound fiscal policies. At the Commonwealth Matters, we have conversations with leading thinkers and policymakers to help us think biblically about the great issues of the day. If you appreciate our work, then please consider a donation today. This work is entirely supported by people just like you. Your gifts and tax-deductible contributions help to underwrite this program, and you help to get this important message out all across the Commonwealth. We believe that the Commonwealth of Kentucky is a great place to live, and we want to keep it that way for our families and our children. That's why we're standing for what's right, for what's good, and what's true right here in Kentucky. Thanks in advance for your support, and may God bless you.
some have argued that Congress is just happy to pass the buck. They don't want to go on record taking a hard vote on tariffs. And I think we've seen that in the past. But when it comes to something as important as trade policy, we want our congressmen to weigh in on the conversation. It's Congress that has set trade policy in the past. And I don't know. So I want to go back to something here, Brian, about just if we are hitting the reset button, what Trump is doing to reset this to become a fairer playing field. Why haven't Congresses, though, apart from their just passing the buck? We've got a huge national debt, over $36 trillion. The American people are taxed pretty heavily from the federal government. Why hasn't Congress or previous presidents said, hey, we need to do something different? We need to relieve the tax burden on the American people. We need to look at other ways to raise taxes. We need to very well make certain that other countries are treating us fairly. And yet it took a Trump presidency to insist on this. Now, Trump he's talked about tariffs for some 40 years. He campaigned on it recently. He said, if I'm elected, we're going to impose tariffs on countries that are taking advantage of us. But why hasn't it been? Are we complacent? Are people afraid to upset the apple cart? What's your observation of what has happened prior to this? Because this has been a problem long in the making.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that in the long term, I think there are two causes. The first is that there is an income tax. So there's a domestic engine for federal revenue. So once you started that in 1913, once it got big in World War One and stayed big, I mean, the federal top rate of the income tax was over 63% for 50 straight years from 1932 to 1981. Okay, well, once you have this gigantic domestic tax collection machine that's inescapable because habeas corpus, we have the population within our domestic borders. You know, you don't have to pay a tariff if you don't come to the United States with goods. That's easy not to do. It's easy not to make an ocean travel with a ship. But it's hard to, you know, survive in this country without earning income because, you know, you have to earn income to survive. So once you got this domestic machine after 1913 collecting tax revenue, the tariff became superfluous. Oddly enough, the tariff then went up because you didn't need the money. They took the tariff rate so high in 1930 that it lost revenue. That was the Great Depression. So it was in 1934, the second cause. So first reason we have weird tariff policy is we don't really have to be serious about tariff policy because we don't need the money because of the income tax. But then the second reason is in 1934, Congress delegated its tariff power to the president, Franklin Roosevelt, and he was going to try to negotiate down bilaterally the high rates of the Smoot-Hawley tariff. And that power more or less has stayed with the president. The thing is, it doesn't seem to be constitutional at all in that the legislative article of the Constitution says Congress shall have the power to lay duties, which are the stuff of tariffs, tariffs duties. And you can't just with a vote in Congress say, hey, we transfer this constitutional power to the executive. No, you have to amend the Constitution for that. So it's probably unconstitutional in any kind of serious way for the president to enact tariff policy without the prior approval of Congress. So I expect that expedient of 1934 to have a rough going in the near future.
Perhaps this will be a talking point for Democrats when they run at the midterm elections next year. Maybe they'll talk about Congress regaining their power to lay duties on foreign imports. Brian, I listened to a podcast where Larry Summers, former Secretary of the Treasury, weighed in. He was very critical of the tariffs. He believes it is going to damage the economy. He's argued, and along with others, have argued that there should have been a scalpel approach, just negotiate. And I don't want to bring you into the negotiating part. That's not your area of expertise. But the argument has been made that there should have been a more surgical approach to leveling that playing field and then to focus on maintaining the relationships with our trading partners. At the same time, you see where countries have responded very quickly. I think it's over 70, maybe 80 countries have come to the trading, come to the table, so to speak, and they want to renegotiate. We've seen where Canada and Mexico have responded right away. We've had fentanyl flowing across our borders, and both Mexico and Canada have responded quickly and working with us. So you have both, again, both arguments. I know I'm bringing up a lot here, but you have those that are saying the scalpel approach, those that are saying, hey, we need to negotiate across the board, and we are holding the cards. What would you, what's your observation with this? What other things maybe that I'm missing or that our listeners are missing as far as just an administration that's serious about leveling that playing field?
I think there is one absolutely unambiguous policy success that has come from the president's actions in this regard. And that is exactly what you mentioned, Richard. All these countries are starting to say, hey, yeah, acknowledge we have high tariffs on you. And if you're going to raise that issue and pressure us on us, we will fold. We would like to get rid of them. Now, that is an unambiguous policy success. And I think it's getting a little bit lost in all this hoo-ha about market drops and all that stuff. Wait a minute. There is what public policy, what is universally regarded as kind of questionable policy that's prevailed throughout the world, kind of against the United States, whatever. And it's been called out now. And then countries are crying, acknowledging that they've been called on it. That's an unambiguous success. That's great. So, yeah, I think that's progress. About Larry Summers, that's an interesting cat. So he thinks there should be free trade. I remember him as high official in the Clinton administration being very high with having upped income tax rates up to 39.6%, up from Reagan's 28% at the top. And I don't remember him saying that would crash the world economy. So isn't that selective? One tax will crash the economy, but another won't. So I think economists have to start screwing their heads on straight about why they hate tariffs and love the income tax, because that's an irreconcilable contradiction.
I think most would agree that most Americans would say the income taxes are too high. Let's find another way to raise revenue. And also,
tariffs should be zero, but income taxes should be 50%. Yeah, sure, right. That makes sense. Yeah,
yeah. Don't run for office on that platform, right? That's not a winning proposition. Brian, I've got a personal element to this story of tariffs in that my wife and I have a small farm in North Franklin County here in Kentucky. And we produce sheep. We've got a small flock of sheep, and we became members of the state sheep and wool producers association. We get messages passed on from the national association, and I'm learning this area and learning about policy. But in a recent newsletter from the national association, they indicated that they've been calling for tariffs on sheep and wool imports for years, up to a 40% tariff, especially on New Zealand and Australia, because they make it difficult for us to ship to their market. They have unfair obstacles. They have they subsidize the sheep and industry. Anyways, they applauded the 10% tariff on sheep coming into the United States, which, by the way, they, according to this newsletter, Australian and New Zealand sheep importers, 99% of the lamb that comes into this country, of the mutton, comes from those two countries, and they're subsidized by their government. And we argue that we're not on the same playing field. I dug around a little bit more, and I found that the sheep industry back in the mid-1900s, 1950s, 60s, 70s, there were, let's see, it was 10 times more the number of sheep in this country than there are today. It was like 50-some million head. Today, it's like 5 million head, something like that. So huge decrease in our domestic production while we've been, all these foreign sheep are coming in. And by the way, just for the record, I'm not against free trade. I think there's many good aspects of it, but I'm for fair trade. And I see how this has hurt a particular industry here in this country. I don't know if you can speak to that.
Yeah, Richard, that's a fascinating example, because let me tell you, wool imports have been a mainstay in the tariff since the very first tariff law, which was the first law really passed by the Congress ever in 1789. The first tariff law enumerates 6 pages worth of specific tariffs, and some of them are on wool. I think wool of alpaca in the 1789 law, I'd have to check. And I just studying the tariff laws over the years, I have seen all sorts of words I had never learned before. Mohair, I see that all the time in the tariff acts. I don't know, what is divi-divi? I don't know. I know it's in the Ford Newcomer tariff in 1922. Is that a nut from Indonesia? Is that, well, I don't, so yeah, there's a strong history, a legacy of tariffs on wool elements coming in from over the years. Yeah, if another country has a subsidy, you know, so that we can get into the biggest market in the world, of course that's offensive. And that, I think, is President Trump's really specific victory in this tariff. He has kind of raised the curtain on all these bizarre practices. You subsidize industry just so you can get into the biggest market in the world and undercut their, what is that? That's not right. Of course it's not right. So that's a proper role for diplomacy and statecraft. And yeah, it's good to do it.
Brian, we are just about out of time, but you've been on record as saying that you don't see tariffs as a sustainable economic policy. Am I correct in saying that?
If we have big tariffs now and really cut the income tax, that would be wonderful. But we can't have big tariffs and big income tax. We can't have, that's the 1930s. We used to have no income tax and big tariffs, and we did great. We used to have high income tax and high tariffs. It was the worst thing ever in modern economic history, the Great Depression. Now we've had high income tax and no tariff. Okay, and that's our mediocre world. So if we want to do a switch where we have a kind of a general tariff, or you know, really get serious about free trade with the world, getting them to lower, you know, plus lowering our domestic taxation, I think that would be best. So either a higher general tariff right now with radical reduction in the income tax, or a really truly free trade world with also a reduction in the income tax.
Yeah, fascinating. Brian Dmytrovic, this has been a fascinating conversation. Appreciate your time. We're going to have you on again to talk about your new book about cryptocurrency. So can you join us in the future?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you. God bless you.